Hello, and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir, and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Each week on the podcast, we look at the three things we think investors need to know or should know for the week ahead. Now, that might be what's happening actually this week, or depending on, you know, if it's a quiet week, we might also be reflecting on some of the longer term trends. And also we'll be doing some of the reading some of the research so that you don't have to. But Alan, before we get to the three things, just a little bit of catch up. We had some feedback, didn't we? We asked last week for feedback on the podcast, and we had some quite nice sort of things that were said about us. And what questions as well.
We did. And I think it was fair. I think people didn't know if it's about now or longer term. And then we're doing both. So
yeah,
that's why you've just made it very explicit, haven't you?
In terms of
how it's meant to be.
Yeah, I think, obviously we talked about this the other day. When there's a lot happening, we're going to be very focused on that week. But when it's a little bit quieter, and it has been a bit quiet over the summer, we'll pick up the key headline stories, but we'll also perhaps reflect on some longer term trends. And like we're going to be doing today, we're going to be looking back at another big market crash and whether there's any lessons that we can learn from those previous events, but also, you know, reading the current research, some of which can be a bit dry so that you don't have to. And also perhaps looking sometimes at what are the stories behind some of the financial press headlines anyway. But also, I believe you were, now I'm very careful every week when we record the podcast to make a disclaimer that we're not giving investment advice, but somebody who's listening to the podcast has gone and bought something, haven't they? What did they buy?
So I've just had lunch with someone, and despite my best efforts to put people off buying Wimbledon debentures, what are this? And I'll say he's a potential client for now.
Okay.
He's gone and bought Wimbledon debentures. To be fair, he's exactly the kind of person who should buy Wimbledon debentures. He's a huge tennis fan.
That was going to be my question. Is he a big tennis fan?
As opposed to looking to monetize the situation. He's a huge tennis fan. So I'm actually rather pleased. And it shows that we're doing something right, I suppose, Sarah.
I know. I'm going to have to express that disclaimer at the end even more strongly, I think, just in case. Anyway, well, let's kick off then. Well, what are we going to talk about? I know we're probably going to talk about data, aren't we? But what other topics do we want to cover today?
So data central banks. On the face of it, there's a lot going on with so many central bank meetings, but it's so well discounted that less so. But data central banks, definitively, on the theme of reading the research. Okay, this was only in the FT, but we've talked about it before. Buybacks.
Yes. Yeah. There's
an article in the FT that's got a fair bit of traction about, buybacks are a little low. And is it because of higher rates? So covering that. And then finally, and this is definitely thematic, ever since Michael Burry from The Big Short, in case you know, remind everyone, who is the actor?
I've had a Christian Bale.
I'm going to help you.
Don't put me on the spot.
Thank you. I did put you on the spot. See, there's very little planning going on with it. Christian Bale, he bought 1.6 billion of put options, which is a very bearish strategy. And therefore, we've kind of been going back in time, at least in my career, the four very big crashes.
Yeah.
And seeing, are there any similarities? Is he looking at something like that? So we covered the 87 crash.
We did.
When I was very, very young. And I honestly thought, God, is every month going to be like this? It's wonderful watching all this. Now, and then we're going to cover the big one, one of the very big ones, 2000 to 2003. We'll cover that. So those are the three things we'll cover. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, let's kick off then with data. I suppose before we get to what central banks are doing this week, we did have US CPI last week, and you told us that the number to watch was the month-on-month figure. How did that come out? Was it in line with expectations or not so good?
I mean, broadly, the core missed by 0.1. So the whole market now is looking at core inflation and hoping for 0.2s and received a 0.3. But we're really getting down to decimal places. I think it was like 0.26 or something, because the year-on-year number was in line. So overall, the market kind of shrugged it off, basically. Okay. But the simple message is, in terms of inflation, US headline inflation obviously is falling a lot. It's got a 3 handle, down from a 9 handle. But core inflation is falling in the US, and it's not falling in the UK or Eurozone. So that is the key difference. And for investors, look, is very important for us all here in the UK. It's all about the United States.
Okay. So, well, that brings us then very neatly on to, we've got Bank of England this, well, we had ECB last week. Perhaps we should just say something about that, because when we talked about the ECB last week and their meeting, it was on the knife edge. It was 50-50, whether they're going to do a rise or not. They did do a hike. I suppose not surprising if they're still struggling bringing core inflation under control.
Yeah, did I get it right? I think strangely, I might have got something very short-term
right. I think you did.
Yeah, because I'm hopeless in the short run. So it was considered a 50-50 meeting. I went for the hike. Why? Very simple. Their rate structure is based on a four handle instead of the Fed and the MPC in the UK at a five handle. So, and core inflation is just as much a problem in the Eurozone as it is in the UK. So I just felt they had more work to do. Again, though, the market shrugged it off because the commentary was dovish. What does dovish mean? Which means, oh, maybe we're not doing any more rate hikes. So the market managed to shrug it off.
But interesting, I read somewhere that apparently the ECB has done more tightening, or as much tightening, I should say, in the last 15 months as the Bundesbank did from 1948. I'm not quite sure what the cutoff date is, but that's quite a lot of tightening, isn't it?
It is, but from crazy negative rates.
That's a good point.
How many times have you heard me have rants about the crazy zero and negative rate structure when it was held for far too long? So it is, and there is going to be an impact. And as people will know, I'm concerned about the economic outlook in the UK because of the structure of the UK, a bit less so in the US, and the Eurozone somewhere in the middle.
Okay. And then just one final question then about the, are we seeing a stronger euro off the back of this stronger, sort of slightly more hawkish ECB?
No, because of the commentary. The market's paid more attention to the commentary than to the rate hike. So no. And in general, the dollar's showing a little bit of strength. Sterling dollar's also drifting down a little bit. So, you know, sometimes, Sarah, there's just a little bit of noise, especially in foreign exchange. You shouldn't make too much of it.
Okay. All right, then. Well, then let's just very quickly then touch on, we've got Bank of England, we've got the Fed this week. Expectations, a hike from one and a pause from the other, maybe?
Yeah. So in terms of UK, it's absolutely expected to be a rate hike. It'd be a big surprise if it wasn't. Hmm. And as for Bank of Japan, that would be a major surprise if something happened. They need to do something at some stage. But yeah, that'd be a major surprise.
Okay. And what about the Fed?
Sorry.
Said Bank of Japan.
Yeah. I've got my mind on the Bank of Japan because that would be the major surprise.
Yes.
The Fed is, it's basically because the Fed is because the Fed meeting is a non-event. Sorry, everyone. Is that they've already said they're not going to raise rates.
Yeah.
So the Fed seemed to be very prescriptive in that. So that, we're not even paying any attention to the Fed meeting.
Yeah.
But I have got a kind of half an eye on the Bank of Japan because if there is an unpredictable central bank out there, it is the Bank of Japan. And it's a bit under the radar, the fact that there is a meeting at all. Mm. So I've got that on my mind, whereas I really haven't got the Fed on my mind now.
Yeah, I guess there'll be more focus, as is often the case with the Fed, on the commentary afterwards, won't there? And what it tells us about what they might or might not do in November.
Exactly. Just like the ECB, all the focus was on the commentary. But even that's pretty, you know, the Fed, unlike other central banks, really, really go out of their way to kind of position markets. They've almost said, we're not going to raise rates, but our commentary will be a bit tough. They've kind of told us that, you know, so you can see that's why I'm really not focused. That's why actually there's a bit of calmness in bond markets and rates markets.
Mm.
It has calmed down a bit. We're getting to more predictable kind of stances on monetary policy now.
Okay. All right. And so to sum up then, we've got, you know, core inflation is falling in the US. It's still on the rise in the UK and Europe. We saw the ECB tightening last week. We've got the Bank of England expectations are 25 basis point rate rise this week. Fed expectations are there'll be a pause with probably a rise in November. Let's wait and see. But Alan's going to be watching what the Bank of Japan are up to. So we're all going to be focusing on the Bank of Japan and we'll pick up on that next week. All right, then. That's data. You want to talk about share buybacks. We talked about share buybacks before. because there's a bit of controversy around them. And there's a piece in the FT that I noticed, which we both read, which, as you said, is gaining a little bit of traction at the moment. And am I right in thinking that buybacks are in decline?
Yeah, I mean, but there's a lot of seasonality to it. But the point they're making is that higher interest rates are taking the edge off buybacks a bit, and to a certain extent. So to give you an example, okay, Johnson & Johnson, the very large healthcare pharmaceutical company in the United States, pays a dividend of about 2.6% over the last 5 years, 2.6%, okay?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So if you buy back shares of Johnson & Johnson, if they buy back shares of Johnson & Johnson, they save 2.6% because they no longer need to pay the dividend.
Makes sense.
So when interest rates were really low, and by the way, Johnson & Johnson is a rare, I think there's not many, AAA rated US company. So they've always been able to issue debt cheaply. Mm. You can imagine if they can issue $1 billion of debt for less than 2.6, then it's self-financing. The dividend gets cancelled. And actually, they issued a 2.25% bond maturing in 2050. So they're paying 2.25% for long-term money. Okay. They're getting tax relief on that. So it's actually only costing them, say, 1.75%. Yet they're buying back shares, which are paying a dividend of 2.6%. So it's a beautiful situation for companies like Johnson & Johnson. So there is some truth in it, but kind of the longer term, by the way, I should say, by way of passing, that bond was issued at 100, paying 2.25% per year. Guess where that bond's trading now? 60.
Oh, really?
That's how bad the bear market is in longer dated bonds. That's how,
wow,
how terrible it's been. And that's why, you know, I nearly always, except when we come to the last topic, will be equities for the long run. But anyway,
so you're getting a nice, if you're buying that on the secondary market at sort of $60 rather than $100, you're getting a decent yield on that, aren't you?
You are. This is not advice, especially on an individual bond. But yeah, so it's been super painful getting here. But yeah, you can say now, one, you're earning that 2.25%, but you've got an uplift from 60 to 100. Okay, it's going to take some time, but it will come through over 2050. Yeah. But this is the way to look at buybacks. Taking the politics out of buybacks, just think of it as an alternative to dividends. That's the way to look at it. So, for example, the average dividend yield in the UK is 4.4%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Yeah. In the US, it's only 1.6%.
Yeah, traditionally don't give dividends in the US as much as we do in the UK.
Exactly. So where's the rest of it? The rest of it is in buybacks. So specifically on Johnson & Johnson, their dividend is reasonable. As you say, in the last 5 years, it's been 2.6%.
Mm-hmm.
On average, they bought back 1.3% of their stock. So 2.6 plus 1.3 equals
3.9.
I'm not going to embarrass you, but just in case your brain is whirring, 3.9. So you can see that's a kind of normal return to shareholders that we see here in the UK. That is the US style. Now, Apple, take that to an extreme because it's phenomenally profitable. Just the Apple numbers, because I've got them here. It's interesting. The last 5 years, dividend yield, roughly 1%. I'm going to round to make it easy to listen to. Dividend yield, 1%. Buyback yield, 5%.
Okay.
So 1% only given by dividends, 5% in buybacks.
Okay.
And Warren Buffett is a big fan of buybacks.
Yes. Is there how much of this also is it? I saw a couple of reasons potentially why that we've seen a slight drop off in buybacks. One was the tax that was introduced in the US, the 1% tax, which potentially could go up, I guess. And also that the mini financial crisis we had in the US in the banking sector earlier in the year, has that had an impact as well on share buybacks?
I think that's the right way to look at it. So firstly, there is a 1% tax. It's not big enough yet, but it could get larger.
Mm.
One. Two, then at a sector level, yet the regional banking crisis put both regional banks and even some of the larger banks, you know, became a little bit more cautious. And then the FT is partly right. Higher interest rates do make it marginally less attractive for the likes of Johnson & Johnson to issue debt and buy back shares. But big picture, it's still there. And I'll remind people of how it works and why Warren Buffett likes it. Over 10 years, if you're lucky enough to have 1% of Apple shares, because of all the buybacks, 10 years on today, you own 1.6% of the company.
Without spending any money.
Yeah, well, that's where you like it. Just by being a long-term shareholder.
Yeah.
By being a long-term shareholder, you own more of the company as a minority shareholder.
Yeah.
And that's been a wonderful thing, obviously. And that's really the way to look at it. And I think the Johnson & Johnson is a nice example, you know, and you can see really Johnson & Johnson, going back to the numbers, it really does look like kind of a dividend yield, isn't it? So Johnson & Johnson was, again, rounding 2.5% dividend, 1 to 1.5% buybacks. That's just the same as a UK dividend. And yeah. no one jumps up and down about UK dividends being too high.
So just then to sum up then, are we saying that there is a drop in the levels of buybacks, and it's a number of different factors? We can't really put it down to one thing.
I think that's right, Sarah. I think that sums it up beautifully. But I think buybacks are here to stay unless it's taxed hugely. And then guess what? The likes of Apple, I guess, will be doing much larger dividends. But they're here to stay.
Okay. All right then. Moving on then to our final one. And we're sort of looking back on another one of the big crashes that you experienced in your career and what we can learn from that. And it was the dot-com bubble we're going to look at, aren't we?
Yeah. And the background to this, because Michael Burry and his $1.6 billion from the Big Short, $1.6 billion of put options, what's he eyeing? Is he eyeing something big?
Yeah.
So let's look at 2000 and 2003. On the face of it, as you called it the dot-com bubble. You could argue, are we having an AI bubble? But the numbers, Sarah, the numbers, just thinking about it makes me queasy, because am I known as a stock market bull?
You're definitely an equity bull. You're always in favor of equities for the long run. Yeah.
One time, big time in my career, absolutely. So I didn't call 0809. We'll cover 0809, the financial crisis, but went super bearish, jumping up and down. I was working for ABN AMRO at the time for our pension fund and also our multi-strategy team about the attractions of bonds over equities. Why? It was a huge bubble. But you know what, Sarah? I was way too early. But let me just give you the numbers. This is why I became bearish. So 5 years to 2000, the S&P 500 was up 250%. That's 28% a year.
Okay.
But I haven't given you the NASDAQ yet. The NASDAQ, the NASDAQ was up 820%, 56% a year. Compound. I'm giving compound numbers. So let's compare with now. So if Michael Burry's looking at that compared to now, it's off the scale. So I saw this, and I saw the ridiculous overvaluations. I'll give some valuations in a minute. Okay. And I went bearish equities, but it probably was late 98, early 1999, probably at least 30% too early, as is, it just shows how difficult it is to do.
Yeah.
But let me just go share those. NASDAQ's been in quite a boom the last 5 years, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Let's compare. Okay, 110% plays 820%.
Okay.
So if Michael Burry's looking at 2000 or 2003 as his playbook, it's just not there. And by the way, that's compounding at 16, which is good. The S&P 500 of the last 5 years, 67%. Plays 249.
Okay.
So you can see the boom was ridiculous, off the scales, ridiculous equity euphoria, which I hated.
Yeah.
I
wonder whether with the dot-com, because it was all about the sort of the sort of the growth in the in internet, and everybody was jumping on the sort of internet company bandwagons and business models that worked online. Whereas what we're seeing now, which albeit is a lot more modest than what we saw then, is driven by AI. Is that perhaps got its roots in something a little bit more sort of sound fundamentally, perhaps, than what we saw in the sort of dot-com bubble, do you think? Is that perhaps seems to be a bit less
dangerous? Yeah, there was some very shaky business models in 2000 or 2003. Pets.com comes to mind as a company that went bankrupt. But to be fair, Amazon proved to be a pretty successful company.
Yeah.
And I think you know this because we covered this internally, how much Amazon shares fell.
Yeah, 95%, wasn't
Yeah. Yeah. Amazon, you know, and that's a perfectly good company. And but the this is it. I mean, people, you call it the dot-com bubble, but it was more than that. Okay. Nearly all stocks became ridiculously overvalued. I'm going to give you some, this is a bit number heavy, but we just covered Johnson and Johnson, our favored way of example on healthcare. It traded at 40 times earnings. Okay.
Which is about
40,
double what
so
it is now,
multiples.
I
We,
guess.
yeah, today it's 16 times earnings.
Okay.
We should probably explain that. So price earnings ratios are one of the easier ways of valuing companies. It's by no means the only way, but basically think of it, the multiple of profits that you have to pay. So Johnson and Johnson in 2000, you had to pay 40 times multiple of profit. Today you pay 16 times. I'm going to give you another example. Even boring banks, Citibank, 25 times earnings. Today, 7 times.
That
Okay.
sounds much better.
So, yeah, the ridiculous overvaluation that we had in 2000, and Alan Greenspan saw it even earlier than me. Do you remember irrational exuberance?
Oh,
This
yes, I do
strange
remember
stuff.
that. Yes.
Do you know how early that was? December 96.
Goodness me.
So 4 years before the peak, he kind of he railed against. I mean, I'm with him because I hate. I like, you know, I accept the fact that markets surge. I've talked about surges in equity markets, but this was beyond a surge. I'll give that number again. 5 years, 820% for the Nasdaq. That's beyond a surge. That's ridiculous. Like tulip mania.
And that's not driven by fundamentals, is it? That's euphoria, isn't it? Essentially, it's everybody jumping on a bandwagon.
It was, but the interesting aspect is, though, the euphoria was partly right. The internet was definitely going to change our lives. You
Yes.
know, and by way of example, AOL. Do you remember AOL? Did you ever have an AOL email address?
No, I didn't know.
I
No.
did. 537 times earnings.
Goodness.
You
So
know.
not an NVIDIA.
No, even NVIDIA is cheaper than that. Yeah. And so look, this is the interesting thing is that in a way, society was right to be excited by the internet,
Yes.
but you might say they went about it in the wrong way. So I would say, in summary, Sarah, surely this is not what Michael Burry is looking at. Oh, by the way, again, well, there was a similar analogy. Bond yields were 4, a couple of years before with the peak. They did get to 7. So it's right now, US yields are 4. So you had 7% for 10 years for US Treasuries guaranteed versus these ridiculous valuations. So you can see why I was jumping up and down saying, come on, team, 7% on bonds. That, you know, that is far more attractive. But when you've been compounding your NASDAQ at 56%, when you start saying 7% on bonds is attractive, not many people are listening to you.
No. Were there also a lot of venture capitalists involved in that growth in the Nasdaq in back in
Yeah,
that period
there's a
of
lot of
time?
IPOs. There was a lot of net equity issuance. There was a lot of IPOs, but that's meant to happen. And look, every now and again, maybe it's human nature to have these bubbles. I think the good news is, okay, the last 5 years, I repeat, S&P 500 up 67%. That's strong, but it's not a bubble. So I keep thinking Michael Burry is playing for a 10 to 20% move, not one of these big crashes. And I think we should, as we come to the end of our really big crashes, maybe because we've mentioned before, 10% happens nearly every year. We'll cover some minus 20% corrections. Not that I'm obsessed with crashes.
No, but we can learn from them though, hopefully, can't we?
Well, yeah, there's that. And also, I think, Sarah, if you come to terms with them, then you're more willing to embrace equity investing, which is what it's all about. So look at the worst possible situations. People will probably write in and say, what about the Great Depression of the 1920s? Okay, I wasn't around then. But look at the worst type of situations and then come to terms with it. And finally, there's one kind of overlooked impact of that crisis, which is hedge funds.
What was that then?
Well, hedge funds were phenomenally successful. So the numbers were like this. So it was a huge crash.
Mm.
The NASDAQ fell 80%.
Yeah.
And the S&P 500 fell 50%. I'm rounding numbers. So a 50% correction. Okay. Yeah. How did hedge funds perform? Beautifully in general.
Yeah.
So Coutts had an Orbiter range. We sold that business to Aberdeen subsequently and many others. So it's not about what Coutts had at the time, but the Coutts fund of funds sailed through. I'm going to say the returns over those 2 years will say plus 10 to plus 15 even. So you've got a hedge fund industry delivering plus 10 to plus 15 versus a stock market down 50. What would you do after that?
It doesn't take a long, I wouldn't need to think about that one for very long. So what would they, I mean, explain them for those that don't understand how hedge funds operate, just to finish off here, what were they doing then that was so much better than if you'd invested in markets?
So long short, so being long in equity and short in equity. But the superstar strategy from 2000 to 2003 was something called convertible arbitrage.
Okay, so you're going to have to explain that.
Yeah, maybe.
In simple terms.
We might have to save it for 08, 09 when it really unraveled. But basically, yeah. In simple terms, there are bonds out there. So I just mentioned the Johnson & Johnson bond, right? But there are bonds that also give you rights to convert into equity. They're called convertible bonds, okay? And very interesting investments in their own right. And what hedge funds did, they looked at it smartly and said, right, I'm just going to free up the option here. So because the option is so valuable inside this convertible bond. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to hedge out the interest rate risk. Some did, some didn't. So I mentioned bond yields went from 4 to 7. So hedge that out. I'm going to hedge out part of the equity risk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was delta hedging. You remember when I explained put options on a...
Yes, and you talked about delta hedging.
Delta hedging. So it's delta hedging, essentially, the equity. And then you get an option to the upside. Well, delta hedging involves selling short the equity. So because the fall in the markets was so sharp, it meant that basically convertible arbitrage was a very, very profitable strategy, amongst others, as was macro investing. Over 2000 to 2003. Spoiler alert, 0809 was a different story, which we'll come to, the financial crisis. But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that hedge funds looked invincible post 03. And really, it sucked a lot of money into hedge funds because it looked like we'd found the magic solution to the financial markets. Yeah. Don't worry about equity, but you know, you don't need to be an equity market that goes up 250%, I'm talking about the S&P 500, then falls 50%. That's horrible. Okay, it's nice if you capture the plus 250%, but the whole volatility is awful. Hedge funds give you a nice smooth ride, making anything from 7 to 10% compound. And they did. But just like a lot of things in life, something that's really successful, the very success undermines the case for 0809, because I think people were complacent going into 0809, including myself. And we'll cover that next week, unless there's huge developments in the current financial markets.
Okay, right. Well, we're definitely coming back to that then, and we'll talk a little bit more about hedge funds then. So it's fair to say then, if we go back to what I call the dot-com bubble, we don't think that Michael Burry's seeing anything today that is a reflection of what we saw then, with the bubble in well, not just in internet sort of base stocks, but actually it impacted blue chip stocks as well, didn't it? But it's just interesting to see how that one played out. And I think I read somewhere that I think the NASDAQ, it took 15 years to recover from that very dramatic, what was it, nearly 80% fall in
value. Minus 80%. Just the maths is horrible. The compounding maths.
But yeah, longer term. i.e. longer than 15 years.
Yeah.
All right, then. Thank you very much, Alan. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com. And of course, if you're not already, please subscribe via Apple, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcast. We'll be back next week, and time permitting, we'll be talking about the global financial crisis and what happened to hedge funds. There's a cliffhanger for you.
Terrible. I think people know. Terrible.
I think they probably do.
Even some really superb names like Citadel out there. But we'll come to that.
Okay. Anyway, until then, bye for now.